Brother, begin the process.
It is no small matter.
It is necessary.
Brother Jurgian shook his head.
We cannot affect the fate of Vanguard's ports. Whatever information we may garner would be cursory and would not alter our course.
Brother, the Gulf teems with Palmaris Town warships, likely Delaval ships as well. Lady Guaidra is cut off from her people, and those people may well prove critical in our battle with King Yezelnik.
We cannot affect the fate of...
Information is power. We have in our grasp the greatest weapon of all. We can see events far removed and know the outcomes weeks before our enemies can adjust accordingly. We will be the quicker.
Father Otto Levin did not agree with you. You tried to make this argument with him, no doubt, and yet he did not assemble the brothers and hand them soul stones that they might go forth in spirit alone. The edicts of our order...
And yet, even as you argue with me, you would have sent the brothers forth in spirit to inform the other chapels of the passing of Father Otto Levin.
There are times for such risks. We sent word of the canonization of Blessed Abel. We came to you in spirit in the far north of Vanguard with word of war.
And so you shall go to Vanguard again with news of the war and with words of rally. And to gather information from the northern holding that Dame Guaidra can rest easy as she continues her battle with Yezelnik.
You ask far more than a single simple journey, and far more than the communion with prepared brothers on the other end.
I do.
The risks are unprecedented. Many will die.
I know.
Yet you persist in this madness. Also, Dame Guaidra can rest easy.
He would.
The speaker, Dame Guaidra, entered the room.
For that... And so that we might learn of events in the Gulf. Events that may well determine our course here at St. Mirabel.
She looked to Father Primusian and nodded her chin toward the door. The monk caught the cue and promptly left them alone in the room.
Pray speak your mind, bluntly.
Jurgian looked at her skeptically.
I have been at war for more than a year, brother. I have witnessed utter carnage in Vanguard villages where every man, woman, and child was slaughtered by vile trolls. I stand here now amid a rain of catapult throws. I promise you, your words will not hurt me.
We should not risk the walking so casually as I was commanded. To send brothers out across the Gulf on so regular a schedule is madness.
It is necessary.
And this is why you elevated Father Primusian to the leadership role.
Father Otto Levin selected his replacement, as is acceptable in times when a formal council of masters cannot be convened.
Father Otto Levin acceded to your request. Dame Guaidra asked him for Father Primusian.
You heard such a thing?
I deduced such a thing.
Had you been in attendance, I admit you would have heard such a thing. The choice was logical. None here have more experience than Father Primusian. None have served the order more loyally, and none have shown such nimbleness.
Nimbleness?
Jurgian was perplexed. Only for a moment, though, as he considered the history of Dame Guaidra and the Order of Blessed Abel. Her war with the Samhaists hadn't begun out of whole cloth, and one of the precipitating events to ancient Baden's turn against her was her intimate relationship with a monk. Guaidra had fallen in love with a brother of Chapel Pellinor, and Father Primusian had known about it from the beginning.
Nimble.
He understands me, and he compliments my decisions appropriately.
And he follows your orders, obviously.
Oh, nay, not that stubborn one.
He has ordered me to prepare rooms of meditation and to send many brothers to the corners of the world, particularly across the Gulf of Corona, to gather the information you desire.
Because he knows it is the correct tactic. We are trapped in here, brother, as Ethelbert was trapped in his city. Our enemies run across the land and sail across the seas. We must know the result of their movements if we are to properly counter.
And you must know of your beloved Vanguard.
I want to know, wouldn't you?
But you would not have us impart the word of Father Otto Levin's death?
Oh no, we cannot do so. Not while Yezelnik holds so visible an advantage. Such news will strengthen the hand of Father de Gilb in this dangerous time. If Father Otto Levin is no more, then those brothers at the many chapels across the land may well turn de Gilb's way. He has King Yeselnik's sword. He is the easier choice.
You have little faith in the brothers.
I understand human weakness, brother. I understand that even brave men may need a measure of hope to facilitate their course to battle. Now is a time of great uncertainty in the chapels of Hans, a time of confusion and difficult choices. Now is not the moment to herald the death of Father Otto Leven, who has stood so bravely against the tyrant Jeselnik.
Jurgen considered for a few moments, then nodded his agreement to all of it.
You would have most travel across the gulf, even though the more immediate events lie to the south?
This was not my fight, and I am unknown to many of the folk in the southern holdings of Hans. But it is my battle now, and by Father Otto Leven's own design, I will be presented as a possible alternative ruler to both lairds, Jeselnik and Ethelbert. Is this not true?
It is.
And so our ultimate hope rests in the security of Vanguard. For if Jeselnik claimed that land in conquest, then with what title might I presume to climb the throne of Hans? I am Dame Guidra only because that northern holding, Vanguard, is my domain. Without it, I am merely Guidra.
Once more, Jurgian felt his cheeks flush with embarrassment. He had thought that he was correct in his arguments against Dame Guidra's course, mainly because he had presumed the woman had not thought through her plans. In a strange way, though, when his embarrassment worn away, Jurgian was comforted by the forethought and calculation of Dame Guidra. He even viewed the promotion of Father Primuzhan in a new light, more complimentary to this woman. Yes, Guidra had manipulated Father Otto Leven, had lobbied him hard for her preferred successor. But truly, given his experiences with the kind and wise father from Chapel Pelennor, Jurgian could not disagree with Father Otto Leven's decision. The brother argued no more. He assembled the brethren of St. Mirabel that very night, choosing from their ranks those most powerful with the gemstones and most seasoned in the act of spirit walking.
Information is power, a weapon we will use to bludgeon this pretend King Jeselnik and the traitor De Gilb.
They began assembling that weapon in the dark of night, insubstantial spirits moving through the shadows with not a whisper of sound. At Bonagrand's insistence, Branson stayed in Chapel Pride and out of sight the next day when King Jeselnik and his grand entourage entered Pride Town. Jeselnik rode in splendor in a coach befitted with sparkling jewels and leafed in gold. The army of Dalaval marched behind Jeselnik's coach, 8 abreast and stretching for miles down the road, more than 20,000 strong. Master Riandu stood beside Bonagrand before the gates of Castle Pride. The monk stiffened. His discomfort was not lost on Bonagrand as the glittering coach wheeled to a stop just outside the gates. Attendants scrambled to the door to pull it wide and place a short stairway before it to help King Jeselnik and then Queen Olin descend. Others carried the royal chairs, but Jeselnik waved his away and started toward the waiting laird even before Olin had taken her seat.
Laird Panlamaris and Prince Mirwellis have besieged the traitors inside Chapel Bell, land and sea. And the treacherous Otto Leven and that beastly Dame Guidra will sit in their hall and witness the birth of my kingdom all around them.
Bonagrand respectfully bowed to acknowledge the important news, but didn't look down as he did. Instead, watching as 4 bearers, slaves captured from Ethelbert's army, carried the powdered and vain Queen Olin. Behind her came a large monk, tall and wide, a giant of a man, perhaps 10 years Bonagrand senior, but showing little sign that he was past middle age in his steady and strong gait.
This is Master Riandu?
It is.
Father Otto Leven has betrayed Hans.
Riandu didn't blink. He knew enough of the story to realize that this was Father De Gilb.
Chapel Abel.
St. Mir Abel, they call it now.
They shame Abel with their exploitation of his name at this time.
You do not think our founder worthy of sainthood, Father?
That is a process, Master, and one ignored by Father Otto Leven for no better reason than to separate himself from King Jeselnik. We both know why this time was chosen for Abel's ascent to sainthood. The cynicism of that premature proclamation shames the memory of Abel.
We shall discuss this in private, Father.
The business of the church is the business of Hans. All that we do in the name of Divine King Jeselnik.
Divine King?
It is Providence that has brought this great victory and circumstance. Abel, great Abel, started the process, and here, less than a century later, we find Hans soon to be united under this man. This divine king. and we as ministers of the word must accept that truth and embrace it. Ortolevin believed that it was time for the order to evolve, and he was right, though his direction was the past and not the future. It is time now for the Church of the Divine King to stand behind this man who has won Hans and united her. All the land will know peace if we stand strong.
The father of Saint Mirabel and all the masters within would not agree with you, Father.
They have made themselves irrelevant by their obstinacy and their treason.
Jeselnik motioned to Gilb to move back beside him.
So, as with the Lairds of Hans, the chapels too are pressed into choice. Where will Chapel Pride stand when Bonagran leads my armies to the gates of Etherbird Dosental? This time to destroy the outlaw Laird.
Master Iando and his brethren will march beside me, of course. Their gemstones will serve the men of Pride as they have without question and without reservation these long months of trial.
Indeed. And tell me, regarding my edict on the disposition of the prisoners...
Those prisoners taken from the field who were once loyal to King Jeselnik serve in my ranks.
And those loyal to Ethelbert?
Eliminated to a man. Your orders were explicit. There are none loyal to Laird Ethelbert in Chapel Pride, or in all of Pride Town.
That is good. Then the choice by Master Riandu has already been made, and made correctly.
We will march with Laird Bonagran, my king.
I will add 10,000 to your ranks, Laird Bonagran. March east, and not south. The Southland has gone wild, and no supplies will be found there. I charge you with the defeat of Ethelbert. Claim his cities for me, and I will widen your holdings greatly.
Bonagran bowed and did well to hide the contempt on his face. This assault should have been accomplished months before, when the combined armies of Jeselnik, Bonagran, and Milwellis had converged on Ethelbert Dosentel. Still, with 10,000 extra soldiers, Bonagran didn't doubt that he could win the day and the city.
Beware Ethelbert's assassins! The highwayman.
The highwayman is not in Ethelbert's employ, nor has he ever been.
He killed King Delavon!
Nay, my king. We were mistaken.
His blade broke off in my uncle's chest. I gave that very blade to you.
Nay, my king, it was not his blade. It was the sword of Afwenwi, a murderess hired by Laird Ethelbert.
How can you know this?
I am closer to Laird Ethelbert's lines. Afwenwi's exploits and those of the mercenary band have been whispered all about, and I do not doubt them. The broken blade you gave me surely resembled the sword of the highwayman, but the patterns carved into the silvery metal were wrong. On closer look, Master Riandu informed me of this.
It is true. We have confirmed it. The assassins who killed your uncle were in the employ of Laird Ethelbert. But Branson Garibond, the man known as the Highwayman, was not among them.
The Highwayman is still wanted for other crimes. You would do well to drag him to me, or deliver his head at least.
There are few in the world who understand this murderous from bear. Perhaps the Highwayman...
Bonagran cut him short with an upraised hand.
The Highwayman is a blood enemy of this Afwenwi creature. She and her order are not in favor of the cult he claims as his own. He will likely kill her and solve our problem for us.
You seem to know a lot about him.
You charged me with finding him. To do that, I needed to learn all there is about him. Knowing one's enemy grants power. I know where he is, and I know where he is going. And that path will lead him to do battle with Afwenwi. Whatever the outcome of that fight, our position, your kingdom, is strengthened.
You let him go once, and I forgave you. I will not forgive you again if the highwayman escapes.
Yes, my king.
I grant you 10,000 of my soldiers to strengthen your own 5,000. Secure every village between Pride and Ethelbert, and then lock the wretch in his city by the sea. I will join you at his gates, and we will push him into the sea and be done with him.
It will be my pleasure, my king. But I would ask of you a short respite for the soldiers.
What do you mean?
A week of rest and plentiful food here in Pride Town. We have been marching from coast to coast. Many have feet so swollen they cannot tie shoes upon them.
A week? A week for that dastardly Ethelbert to strengthen his defenses? No, I say, go and kill him. Go straight away, I say.
The forward scouts will be out this very night.
And the rest of you?
As soon as I can organize the forces appropriately.
Tonight? Tomorrow morning?
That would be a disaster. I know not your men or their leaders. To simply march off without the proper precautions would risk attrition and even skirmish within our own ranks.
I would have Ethelbert.
Indeed. And with 2 days' preparation, my march will be swift and strong.
Jeselnik looked as if he wanted to step his feet like an angry child, and even crossed his arms over his chest. But Bonagran would not back down. In the end, the warrior Laird got his way. King Yeselnik was back on the road to the west soon after, leaving behind a tent city of soldiers now under the command of the Laird of Pride. To Riandu's great relief, Father de Gilb departed with the king.
You'll not kill Branson.
We have a deal. Once he has dispatched Afwenwi,
King Yeselnik will still demand his execution.
He will charge me with that. But alas, I will never quite catch up to the highwayman.
You told him that he could live in Pride Town with his family.
What will you have me do, monk?
Riandu wanted to shout that Bonnegrand should defy Yeselnik, should demand that Branson's name be cleared. For there was no answer to Bonnegrand's question. King Yeselnik would not be persuaded by any sense of justice. He turned to leave the room.
Tell Branson to shadow our march in disguise, and to speak only with you or me directly. 3 days from now, perhaps 4.
It fits you well. It fit your father well.
Riandu spoke to Branson after the young man put on the brown woolen robe the monk had offered.
Even in your days with us so long ago, I never imagined that I would see Branson in the robes of an Abelican brother.
They are as uncomfortable as they are impractical.
More uncomfortable to you because of what they represent, no doubt.
As they will become to you when Father de Gilb claims supremacy over your church.
Few will follow him.
Fewer will follow Riandu to King Yeselnik's gallows. I am no longer amazed by how quickly a man will justify his change of heart when a spear is leveled his way.
Your cynicism is inspiring.
Only because you know it to be well placed.
Do I?
Branson shrugged as if the answer should be clear.
I am afraid. I fear that de Gilb will win, and those at St. Mirabel will pay for their courage with their lives.
It seems a likely outcome. But not all, I promise you. Caedale is there, and Yeselnik will not have her.
Because she is something for which the highwayman will fight. But the rest of Haunts be damned.
The rest of Haunts is beyond my influence.
The women and children of Haunts, the helpless elderly of Haunts, all of them can be trampled under Yeselnik's armies, or Ethelbert's armies, and Branson cares not. Those miserable peasants who suffer under the horrors of this war are not Branson Garibond's concern. The thousands of Garibond Womacks who try to simply live their lives without upset are not your problem.
You cannot place that burden upon me.
I should not have to. The Branson I knew would take it upon himself.
Bonnegrand stared out the eastern window of his room in Castle Pride overlooking the chapel. Once again, the highwayman had come into his life, and once again he had not killed the outlaw. Why would he show such mercy to this one? He could claim pragmatism in each instance, but he knew that doing so would only half answer the question. What was it about the stork that had so often stayed Bonnegrand's hand? Respect? Perhaps, for none could question that the resilient young man had overcome tremendous obstacles in his life, as none could question the prowess of the warrior. But it was more than simple respect, Bonnegrand believed, though he had never taken the time before this moment to actually sit back and try to sort it all out. The last candle went down in Chapel Pride across the way, its small windows going dark. Riandu and the brothers had retired for their last night in Pride Town, perhaps forever, Bonnegrand knew. He hadn't actually lied to King Yeselnik when he had declared that Riandu would be by his side for the march to the east, or that Riandu and the brothers would serve well the army of Pride in Delaval. But neither had he told King Yeselnik the whole truth, for Bonnegrand knew Riandu well enough to understand that the monk would never betray the Order of Abel for this new church of the divine king that the brutish de Gilb had proclaimed. No, Riandu and most of the brothers would not remain in Pride Town under that option. They would flee to St. Mirabel or somewhere else beyond the immediate reach of Yeselnik. That thought troubled Bonnegrand deeply, and he was surprised to realize that truth as he mulled it over. He had no wife, no family, and indeed no friends other than Riandu. Yes, Riandu was his friend. Not a friend like the sycophantic and opportunistic young nobleman who followed him about his court, laughing at his every joke with too much enthusiasm. Not a friend like the many women Bonnegrand took to his bed, all eager to steal his heart and claim a place as the Dame of Pride. Riandu wanted nothing from him, though, in many ways, the brother demanded more of Bonnegrand than any other person alive. Yeselnik ordered Bonnegrand to follow his orders, but Riandu always reminded Bonnegrand to follow his heart. which was the more difficult course by far. The Laird thought back to the scene in the dungeons the previous day. Would he have killed Branson had not Riandu intervened? Certainly, he was moving with that intent, and certainly he was angry enough with the highwayman to do so. But no, he realized, he would not have killed Branson. He did not want to kill Branson. Why was this one so different from all the others who had errantly crossed Banagran's path and inspired his wrath? Why this man, whose actions had led to the death of Banagran's dearest friend, Laird Priday? A wistful look came over the face of the Bear of Hunts. He felt a kinship to Branson, for, like himself, the young man was a victim of his physicality. Branson's infirmity had trapped him as the stork for most of his life, had determined his course in life. So it had been with Banagran. At the age of 15, young Banagran had been stronger than any man in Pride, and his proficiency in the fighting arts had caught the attention of Laird Pride. And so Pride had summoned him to the castle and had enlisted him to befriend his son Priday. Thus had Bonagran's life path been set in motion. He and Priday had trained together, had ridden together, and, when they were still teenagers, had gone to battle together. Banagran the bodyguard had become Banagran the trusted friend, and so he had spent the whole of his adulthood in Castle Pride beside the prince who became the Laird. He had achieved a great reputation through great exploits. He became known as the Bear of Hunts, the champion of Pride, and lairds from all around Hunts had taken note of him in the Powry Wars in the East. It had been a grand life, full of adventure, full of wine and women and rousing cheers. So why, now, did he feel so empty, so without purpose? He was the Laird of Pride Town, a community flourishing under his control. He was the commander of King Yezelnik's main force, and his men loved him and would follow him to the gates of the demon Dactyl's lair if he so asked them. Strangely, he didn't care.
Despair. It is a trap, or it is the awful truth, the stark and undeniable realization of ultimate futility. My legs are now strong, but I stand on shifting flats of mud. I am straight now in posture, but crooked in vision, for I have glimpsed the horizon, and it is a dark place. Not for any Dactyl demon, not for any goblins or trolls or powries, but dark by the incessancy of mankind's foibles. In weakness, in pride, they will call themselves God. In envy, they will kill their neighbor. In wrath, they will lay waste to the fields. In sloth, they will let their neighbors starve. In avarice, they will steal all unto themselves. In greed, they will hoard excess. In lust, they will damn consequence. The Book of Jest was my companion. Words copied by my father, wisdom garnered by the generations of Jester II mystics over the centuries, their reflections of the simple truths of the world. The book, my companion, resides in me still with passages I had thought unraveled, but which reveal to me new secrets as my experience grows. Once I read In Weakness and saw a world not worth redeeming, and then I was the highwayman. Then, with Caedale by my side, I considered the passage as a warning against my own limitations and darker potential. Now I fear it as inevitability, for I have come to profoundly fear that there is no lasting goodness, nor can there be. With great hope did my father return from Bear, the Book of Jest in hand, the song of the Jester II on his lips, and Senwi beside him. They killed him for his optimism, for his idealism, for his hope that there was a better way. How many hours, how many days, how many weeks, how many months did he toil to copy those words? How many times was a page discarded because a single symbol was pinned wrong? The permanence of wisdom etched on a fragile parchment so easily lost. And will the concerted effort of a future king collect them all and destroy them? And will all the followers, the Book of Jest etched into their thoughts, be gathered and slain? Inevitably so. And what then is left? What worth art and the just swing of sword? What small steps might man move forward? When a single man of ill design, of lust and greed may just consign to the ashes the work of those before and halt their march forevermore. That is my despair, that the accumulation of justice and goodness is an illusion, a temporary stay. One King Yezelnik will erase the gains of Dame Gwaedri. One Father de Gil will chase away the call of Cormac's justice. A Gwaedri or a Cormac might win, but eventually will a Yezelnik claim the throne, or will a de Gil steal the church? And then the darkness settles, and justice is scattered, and the memory of Senwi dies with me, and the memory of Brandenard is lost in the ashes of Garibond Womack. Is it no more than a circular road? Can the work of good men do no more than stretch it to the shape of an ellipse? For so long I dared not believe so, but now I see no other possibility. In that case, then what is the point? I do not know. The mud shifts below my feet. In Pride Town, the highwayman was a selfish man. In the cold north, under the tempting optimism of Dame Gwaedri, the highwayman found wider purpose. But on a road in the east, in the death of Jameston Sequin and the betrayal by Afwin Wee, I was reminded all too clearly of the circle that is the fate of man. The mud shifts again. I know that I want my mother's sword. For that I will fight. I know that I demand the brooch Father Ottolevin entrusted to me. For that I will fight. These are my two immediate certainties, and my third, Kaedale, awaits. Would that I could fix the world. But another Yezelnik will claim the throne, and another de Gil will steal the church. And the flames of an Abelican ruby consume the Book of Jest. Sometime, somewhere, out there just over the dark horizon. Branson Garibond.
Just piss your pants.
Engren's tent companion crawled over him on his way to the exit.
It'll keep you warm.
It's summer, and I don't want him stinking worse than he's already stinking.
Shut your mouths, the both of you.
Collie Andedin pushed aside the tent flap and crawled outside.
Tired of being an animal, I am.
It's what we be. You're a soldier, a dog. Thrust your spear and wear your enemy's blood and stink like piss and mud all year long.
We'll be back to Comey Downs in a month.
Collie referred to their home village just north of Delaval City. He was not a young man, and the ground was unforgiving to his old bones. He pulled himself up to one knee.
Home. And with it all done, with Ethelbert done, and Yezelnik the King of Hunts and no more fighting, me wife's not liking the smell of piss much.
A month, yeah. A month and we'll be getting slaughtered outside Ethelbert's gate. And if the bear finds us a way to win, our reward will be to march to Chapel of Bell, dodge the spears of Ethelbert, dodge the lightning bolts of the monks. All's the same and not the end. I'm thinking the dying might be the only escape.
Collie wasn't listening any longer. He was miserable enough without letting Engren's constant complaining weigh him down even further. He had spent a few good weeks in Comey Downs with his wife and five children. While going out on the road had been emotionally troubling, Collie had mitigated his despair with a reminder that this was likely the last march. They were going for Ethelbert, King Yezelnik had told them, and would be under the guidance of the great Bonnegran the Bear. All the way to Ethelbert Dos Entel to end the war, with Collie's group and 10,000 Delaval soldiers backing the legendary 5,000 veterans of Pride. Given the reputation of Bonnegran, whose name was whispered reverently by ally and enemy alike, Collie believed that they would do just that, that this time the thorn of Laird Ethelbert would be eliminated. And they had the monks with them, almost all of them, led by Master Riandu himself. Rumors also spoke of another ally, a small man many believed to be the highwayman. This time, the assault was for real, Collie told himself, and not like that inexplicable retreat they had executed all the way back to Delaval. He moved away from the dying campfires into the brush to relieve himself. He caught a movement out of the side of his eye a moment later and thought it must be another of the soldiers coming out for similar reasons. The man was fastening his pants when the hood went over his head and his legs got kicked out from under him. A fine cord went around his throat, stopping his breath. He tried to reach up and loosen the cord, but fingers knifed into one armpit, then the other, and for some reason the collie did not understand, his arm seemed to simply die, all strength gone. He was down on his face in moments. He tried to kick and thrash, but someone fell atop him.
Sleep, sleep.
He felt the cord loosen some time later, felt the ground under him as he was dragged along. He stood on the edge of unconsciousness for a long time, too weak to call out, but not quite escaping the sensations all around. His captors sat him up against a tree and tugged his arms hard behind him, his wrists bound around the other side of the tree trunk. The hood came off and Collie saw her in the moonlight right before his face. The second he realized she was a beast of bear with her almond-shaped dark eyes and black hair, he knew he was doomed. She smiled at him disarmingly, then slapped him hard across the face. He felt a claw-like implement, like the head of a garden rake, come up tight against his groin.
If you yell out, I will make your death hurt.
Collie stared at her, his eyes wide, licking blood from his split lip.
Do you understand?
Collie nodded, eyes wide.
Where is your army marching?
East!
She pressed in with the claws against his scrotum.
To Ethelbert Dos Entel?
Yes.
You march to kill Laird Ethelbert?
No, I'm just a soldier. I'll do what they tell me.
How many soldiers?
Lots. 5,000 are pride. The rest are from King Yeselnik.
Yeselnik is not the king. Ethelbert is the king.
I'm not caring for who's the damn king.
The woman stepped back and stood up straight. She glanced over her shoulder at the man Collie could not see.
Mirak des virum bektek nost.
And she turned back, and her smile, her awful smile, told him.
Please, 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 go up, pick up, please, no.
Out snapped her leg. Perfectly aimed, her foot slammed into Collie's throat with jarring force. Collie felt nothing as he fell over. He kept trying to draw breath, but none would come. The man moved above him. He sensed that he was about to be finished off, but the woman intervened.
Let him die slowly. Let him know that he's dying.
Collie watched the man and woman walk away, but that offered little encouragement to the suffocating, paralyzed man. He thought of his wife and their kids. He dreamed of working the fields with his sons, of going home that night to hot pumpkin pie or apple pie. Yes, apple, he decided. For none in Komi Downs could make an apple pie better than Maisie Andedin. The starlight faded to black. Branson sensed something. He couldn't be sure of what exactly, but he had come out of his meditation certain that something unusual was afoot in the dark and quiet night. He unwound himself from his cross-legged position and came to his feet. Branson narrowed his gaze and scanned the dark forest beyond the campfires. He thought of the gem-encrusted star brooch then, and the cat's eye agate that allowed him to see in the dark. How he wished he possessed such a gemstone now. Branson closed his eyes and recalled the stone and the sensations of its magical emanations. He could nearly levitate without malachite, so when he opened his eyes, he tried to mimic the cat's eye magic and found, to his surprise, that the dark was not nearly as absolute. Off he went at a swift pace. He started to discard his uncomfortable monk robes as soon as he moved out of sight of the tents, but he changed his mind. If he were caught here by Bonnegrand's men, it would not do well for them to recognize him as the highwayman. The highwayman moved with grace, gliding through the shadows with ease, hearing every sound about him, smelling the scents of various animals. He wasn't sure what had stirred him from his contemplation, and his direction seemed random to him on a conscious level, but he continued on, trusting in his instinct. He found a soldier lying in the dirt, very still. Branson soon discerned that a single blow to the throat had felled the man, though he had been beaten somewhat before that mortal strike. Blood had started to cake on his face from the broken nose. A glance at the tree, at the hair and blood stuck on its bark at less than waist height, informed Branson even more of what had just occurred there. The fallen man was not breathing. Branson grabbed the man's windpipe and gently massaged it, glad for the soulstone Riandu had offered. He used that magic now, sending waves of warm breath into the soldier, repairing his crushed throat and calling his spirit back to his broken form. A long while slipped past, but Branson did not stop his work. He sensed the slightest bit of breath in the man's throat, so, more furiously, he reached for the gemstone magic. He knew with certainty that only one person would have done this, and that gave him great pause. Why was this man still alive? Afwin Wee didn't make such mistakes, and so Branson knew then that it was more likely not a mistake. Was she baiting him, trying to lure him into the open? He looked at the poor soldier, sent his thoughts through the hematite one last time to give the man a bit more relief. The soldier recoiled and curled defensively.
Who are you, and who do you serve?
Collier Comey Downs, for King Yeselnik, and marching with Laird Bonagran.
Rest easy, man. The danger is past.
Two of them, at least. A woman. Beast to bear. She caught me and kicked me.
What was she wearing?
Black. Like the highwayman. Like you.
Collie bit off the word and averted his eyes, and Branson realized that the monk disguise was probably the worst kept secret in the ranks. Within moments, Collie was stumbling back into the encampment, holding his sore throat and happy to be alive. Branson was long gone behind him into the forest, his monk robe soon looped over a branch. He was hunting now. He was the highwayman, a mask over his eyes. He knew now why he had come out of his meditative trance and understood the sensation that had alerted him. It was indeed Afwin Wee. It was his mother's sword and the brooch Artalivan had given him.
Oh, it's correct.
Murwal Yana spoke to Afwin Wee as they noted the highwayman slipping through the trees below the hillock they had climbed to garner just such a view.
He saved the soldier, no doubt.
And the soldier sent him on his hunt for us?
Shall we go and be done with this impudent man?
He will be of use to us in dissuading Ethelbert from any rash decisions.
He is dangerous.
Murwal Yana bit that thought off short when Afwin Wee scowled at him.
You wish to fight him again? One against one.
I will kill him when I must.
Such misplaced honor is just a tool, not who lay.
Honor? Sport!
Branson was still moving, his footsteps coming more slowly, when the eastern sky brightened and the first ray of the sun peeked over the horizon. He ran up a tall tree then, scanning the countryside, but she was gone. He knew it in his heart. Branson lay back against a branch, considering his missed opportunity. Rage bubbled inside him, for he wanted nothing more than to face this Hugh Lee woman and retrieve his sword and brooch, and to kill her, he admitted to himself, for what she had done to Jameson Sequin. But his anger was tempered by thoughts of Kaydale and their unborn child. Could he beat Afwin Wee alone, even though he knew that it was unlikely he would ever get the chance to fight her without Murwal Yana at her side? He had vowed revenge, vowed to get his items back, but sitting there in the tree as dawn brightened the eastern sky, Branson questioned his determination and his confidence. For all the value he placed in that sword, was it worth the price of his life? And not just his life, but the well-being of Kaydale and his child? The army was awake and soon to be moving. Branson looked back the way he had come, estimating the miles between his current position and his monk disguise. He shook his head and started away, not to retrieve the robe, but to intercept Bonagrand's march as the highwayman. Cormac and Milkayla entered Laird Ethelbert's chambers cautiously, still not quite sure of what to make of the elderly but energetic Laird. The summons had been brought by one of Father Destros's monks, which gave the couple some comfort, but the young monk's demeanor, his level of urgency, had also brought trepidation. They entered the room to find Ethelbert sitting with his three generals, Father Destros and another monk to one side, and Afwin Wee and Murwal Yana standing before the throne. At the sight of the dangerous mercenaries, Cormac and Milkayla, holding hands, both squeezed more tightly. Ethelbert turned a stern glare over Destros, promptly dismissing the monk who had accompanied the couple.
Your plans fall like the rain and run to the sewers, it would seem.
Laird?
You would have us parley with Bannagran of Pride, but this man they call the Bear marches now to destroy us.
Cormac looked at Afwin Wee.
She found him less than a week's march from here, along with an army of many thousand, perhaps three or four legions. Most of them are Yezelnik soldiers. There will be no parley with Laird Bannagran. Just the blood. So much blood.
Cormac tried to digest it all. Through it, Ethelbert, Afwin Wee, and Merwal Yana stared hard at the emissary couple.
Perhaps you should ride north to rejoin your Dame Guidra at St. Mirabel. If you remain here, you will be expected to join with all your heart in the battle against the invaders.
No, I pray you, Laird. Does King Yeselnik ride beside Bannagran?
He looked to Afwin Wee as he asked, and the woman shook her head.
He has run back to his castle. Else we would have left him dead on the trail.
Then this is our chance. We must go meet Laird Bannagran. With all speed, to engage him as far from the gates of Ethelbert Dos Entel as possible.
You have gone mad, young brother.
No, Laird. This is our opportunity. Outside of Pride, far from home, Bannagran will find his army much less eager for engagement.
You would have me leave my city defenseless against him while I chase an army more than twice or even thrice the size of that which I might muster?
It would be sheer madness to abandon our walls. Let the Bear of Pride Town come on. We will hold him to the field and rain death upon his army day upon day.
Ethelbert nodded in agreement with Kieran Howen.
Even if what you say is true, even if we hold and slaughter Bonagran's men, to what gain? What is our plan from there? How shall we seize the initiative from Yezelnik and turn back the pressing tide?
Perhaps your Dame Guidra and Father Arta Levin will have that answer, yes? If your suggestion is to take such a risk as to ride forth and face them on the open field, then you are mad.
Cormac looked to Milkayla for support, and the woman took his hand and squeezed hard again.
We knew this would be a great risk, Laird Ethelbert. If not on the field, then we would have had to go to Pride Town to find Laird Bannagran, and that would have been no less difficult. His march may offer us the option of retreat if we prepare the place of meeting correctly.
We've the walls and a protected bay. I can think of no better place to make our desperate offer to Bannagran.
Desperate. And it will seem so if we do it with Bonagran's army camped outside. I pray you, Laird, do not tarry. Meet Bannagran before his goal is in sight, and before he can surmise that your offer of alliance is made of desperation alone. If he believes this to be a last chance for Laird Ethelbert to save his life and his title, then know that he will not be merciful and will not betray King Yeselnik. Go out and meet him, I beg. Bargain from a position of power, not desperation.
You will go and speak for Dame Guidra?
I will.
Even if we do not? If we remain in Ethelbert Dos Entel, Cormac and Michaela will go forth to meet Bannagran.
We will.
He will cut you in half for that massive axe of his.
All that I've heard of Laird Bannagran paints him as a severe but honorable man. An honorable man will adhere to a flag of truce.
You will be killed before you get near to Bannagran.
Afwin Wee drew all eyes to her in surprise. She drew out her sword, Branson's sword, and held it up near Cormac. The man held his breath, confused and wondering if her claim meant that she intended to slay him then and there.
The highwayman? The man you call Branson? The man you call friend? My agents run Bannagran's line as you ordered. I am not surprised by their words that this man, the highwayman, walks among the soldiers.
Like all in the room, Cormac's eyes widened with surprise. Milkayla clutched his hand even more tightly.
We welcomed him as an ally and a student. He has betrayed us.
The highwayman knows much of our defenses, and now Laird Bannagran knows as well.
What have you to say to this?
Branson is from Pride Town.
He would not know.
Everyone looked to Milkayla to see her face as puzzled as their own expressions.
About the offer of Dame Guidra to Laird Ethelbert.
Yes, yes. Branson left St. Mirabel before our plans were crafted, and even before Abel was sainted and Chapel Abel was renamed. He would not know that you, Laird Ethelbert, have agreed to an alliance with Dame Guidra and Father Arto Levin.
He marches with my enemy.
He will kill you in the forest before you get near to Bannagran.
No, Branson would never take up arms against me or Milkayla at the request of any laird or dame or king or father. Nor would he choose battle against Father Arto Levin, and certainly not to side with Father de Gilb. No, I know Branson much better than to even think any of that a possibility for a moment.
He marches with my enemy.
This is the time for men of great courage, Laird Ethelbert. Better that Bonagran is marching east, further from Yeselnik's influence, when we go and meet him. He will honor a flag of parley, and we should all hope that Branson has engendered his trust. Because Branson will join with us, of that I am sure. And Branson is no small voice among the people of Pride, where he is considered a hero, and among the brothers of Pride, including Riondu, the master who presides over Chapel Pride due to Father Jerric's illness.
Ethelbert glanced over to Father Destros at that.
Father Jerric's spirits and thoughts have long left his body, it is rumored.
No better opportunity will we find.
And no further east, and no further removed from the fool Yeselnik, Laird Bannergren be than on the day he arrives on our field.
Where your parley will be viewed as no more than the desperate last plea of a doomed laird and a doomed city. Laird Ethelbert, I beg of you, now is the time. Let us speak with Bonagran and convince him that the winds have changed and that there is a better goal for Hans than the rule of Yeselnik.
The old laird sat there for a long while, mulling, then stood up from his throne and stepped from the dais to address Cormac eye to eye.
I cannot bring my army forth from these gates, for Bonagran is a clever general who would know our strength and weakness and would ensure that he destroyed us out on the field before we were ever able to return to the protection of the city's walls. What a terrible laird I would be to my people to leave the good and trusting folk of Ethelbert de Sentil so defenseless in the face of the ruthless Yeselnik.
Bonagran will honor a parley.
Indeed, he would. But he would, at the same time, and quite morally, position his force to defeat our escape should the parley come to no agreement. And I think it will come to no agreement. It is a desperation plan Dame Guaidra has concocted, and no less so than the stubborn and just defiance of Father Artelevan. I assure you that their courage is not lost on me. How much easier would it have been for both to simply agree to the notion of King Yeselnik? Had Father Artelevan followed the command of Yeselnik to free his men and execute mine across all the chapels of Hans, then the war would likely near its end with Yeselnik's vast army sitting outside my gates at present, if they had not already broken through.
My laird!
Ethelbert turned and motioned to Kieran Howen.
You know.
Howen had to nod his agreement of the laird's dark assessment.
I am grateful to Father Artelevan. His courage and defiance have given hope to my good friend Father Destros there. And I am intrigued by Dame Guaidra. I cannot bring my army forth, for I fear the plan desperate. But yes, young Cormac, the plan is worth the attempt.
You will allow me to go forth?
I will go with you.
No, my laird!
Again, Laird Ethelbert turned away from Cormac to face Mirik and Tyne, his gaze settling on Kieran Howen, who sat with his hand to his chin, taking a good measure on the surprising Ethelbert and passing no obvious judgment.
I and a select group of trusted guards, a small but capable accompaniment.
I would proudly ride with you, my laird. My friend.
And I would be better for having you.
But that cannot be.
Ethelbert nodded, as the two seemed to hold such complete understanding of each other.
Our two young protégés are promising, you agree?
Kieran Howen smiled and nodded yet again.
But they are not tempered well enough to deal with King Yeselnik, should he come a-calling.
I would fight him to the bitter end.
Young and proud Mirik, if I am gone, there will be no need. Ever was this fight between me and Laird Delaval, not between Ethelbert de Sentil and Delaval City. Never was there enmity between our lands. Nay, it was the arrogance of Delaval that started this war, and it is the unbridled ambition of his idiot nephew that perpetuates it. The focus of his ire, the obstacle he seeks to remove, is Ethelbert the man, not the city. I will parley with Bonagran as our friend Cormac here delivers the desperate plan. Should that parley fail, I will try to return to my city, for it is there I wish to die, and not on the fields of some other holding. But that is of no consequence.
My laird!
You should live to be as old as Ethelbert.
I would go as well, my laird, if you would allow.
Father Destros stepped forward.
Father Artelevan has made a brave choice, as you said, and a sorry emissary of my order I would be if I remained here with this important...
Granted. Chapel Entel shall be represented. But I charge you now with softening your words should the parley fail.
Laird?
I'll not have the fate of Ethelbert de Sentil and the bargaining position of Steward Kieran Howen compromised because of a stubborn monk. It would seem as if I have one stubborn monk to contend with already.
I am not of the Order, lad.
So you say.
He will not be king.
Merwal Yana spoke to Efwin Wee when they were alone in their wing of the castle.
He hasn't the stomach for the fight.
The wind blows from many different directions, but all the breeze is against him.
Will you go and dance for him this night? That he might drift off to dreams of who he once was, that he might escape the truth of the weakling he has become.
He is old.
Too old.
And what would you advise?
We are done with this place. This land where our inferiors look upon us as if we are beasts.
You speak like one who hasn't a stomach for the fight.
Ethelbert will not ascend, whatever his course.
Why would you think I am speaking of Ethelbert?
A liar I would be if I did not admit my surprise.
Kieran Howen spoke to Ethelbert a bit later when they were alone in the Laird's sitting room, sharing some fine drink.
No less a liar than myself.
You found Cormac persuasive?
More than 10,000, Afwin Wee said. Perhaps near to twice that number.
And led by Bonnegrin, the Bear of Haunts, not by the foolish and cowardly Yetelnik.
And with soldiers dressed in the fine armor bought by Delaval's endless gold, and likely with a fleet of warships working their way around the coast, and perhaps with that brutish Milwellis returning as well. Did you believe we could survive that, in honesty?
No, my lad. When Yetelnik ran from the field, I hoped we could parlay our position and be done with this war. By all accounts, that cannot happen. He is determined now and wise enough to hide while greater men carry out his commands. The bear will not flee the field, and our walls will not stop his vast army.
I could send Afwin Wee to murder him.
She and the handful around her would have to battle through the finest warriors of pride in Delaval, perhaps, if she is not lying, with the highwaymen among them, and then with Bonnegrin himself. You could try that course, but...
But to what end? The Army of Pride is well seasoned and layered with leadership, all trained under the eye of Bonnegrin. We cannot win and cannot hold. How did our guest Cormac say it? This is the time for men of great courage.
My friend, lad Ethelbert, is such a man.
No man has lived a better life than Ethelbert. All that I have known I owe to this city, my home. It has served me through the decades, loyally and with love. A sorry father I would be to Ethelbert Dosentel if I cowered now behind her walls. Perhaps Dame Guidra's plan will succeed, and all the world will be brighter. But even should it not, my friend, Ethelbert Dosentel will be better for my going. That is the truth I am faced with, and you cannot disagree.
The general sat stone-faced.
And so I am called to be a man of courage. And so it is the time for Laird Ethelbert to truly serve the city that has served him for so long. I am not afraid, and I am not saddened. To see these walls broken by the stones of Yezelnik, to see him ride victorious through the gates, that, Kieran, would bring me tears.
I know my role, Laird. Should you not return, should the armies of our enemies arrive at the gates of Ethelbert Dosentel, I will surrender the city to the King of Haunts.
Is it that you wish to embarrass me or anger me?
Bonnegrin spoke to Branson, who was walking in his highwayman outfit and not wearing the brown robes Riandu had given him.
You employed the highwayman, did you not?
Or like a child, you wish to see how far you may stray before the paddle is applied.
I am not your subject, Bonnegrin.
You claim that you wish to make your home in Pride Town. That would make you my subject, indeed.
On this march, I am your mercenary. Yes, that is a good word for it. I found your soldier in the forest and saved his life, so perhaps we should discuss my payment.
Bonnegrin's grin was not one of agreement, Branson knew.
You wish me along because you fear Afwin Wee, as well you should. I wish me along because I have unfinished business with Ethelbert's murderess. That is the extent of my intended service, and truly you have asked no more of me. But there is more, perhaps.
I have little time for your riddles.
I am your mercenary. Afwin Wee I will defeat because I must, and for my own selfish needs. But I bear no antipathy to Laird Ethelbert's soldiers or to the old fool himself. One Laird is as awful as the next, after all. That ambiguity is double-edged, however. I'll not work towards Ethelbert's defeat out of any sense of loyalty to you or to that idiotic Yezelnik, surely.
but that does not mean that I will not work towards Ethelbert's defeat.
Loyalty to Pridetown, then. It was ever your home, Branson, and certainly that means something.
It means nothing, Master Riondu. It was the place of my torment and my indenture.
I don't believe you.
You hold many false hopes, brother, not the least of which is reflected in those atrocious robes you wear so proudly.
So you will not serve Laird or King, but will do battle against Ethelbert. For gold, I expect.
Do you wish their left ears or the whole head? A king's coin for each I deliver. Do not look so sour at the notion, Bonnegran. Consider instead the value I bring to your ranks.
Why would not every man in the ranks demand the same terms?
Why would I care if they did?
You are truly a wretched creature.
Aye. Am I the man who trampled the fields south of Pride, driving the villages to the foothills in an existence of sheer savagery? Am I the man who claimed the land as my divine right, marching armies over folk who want no more than to fill their bellies on occasion and find a warm bed at night? Am I that man?
You have not the couth to be called a man, any man.
Then I am an animal. Do you fear animals? Consider my terms, Laird Bonnegran. I promise you it will be the best expense of your campaign.
To everyone's surprise, Bonnegran did not dismiss the notion outright, and his expression and posture revealed his intrigue. Clearly, he was considering how he might best utilize this mighty weapon known as the Highwayman. Later that day, when the army had come to a halt, Branson spoke with Riandu.
On the word of Laird Bonnegran himself.
Branson held out his hand.
A sunstone, a malachite, a lodestone, a soulstone, and a cat's eye.
I read the Laird's note.
And yet you hesitate.
No good will come of this.
Was it the mountains of dead soldiers and townsfolk that convinced you? Or the razed villages and ruined fields?
Your insufferable sarcasm tries my patience.
Sarcasm or truth? Is it that Master Riandu hasn't the heart to open wide his eyes, preferring instead the somber reassurances of chapel artwork?
I was not speaking of the war. Perhaps we are closer on agreement on that matter than you might believe. Nay, I was speaking of your evil pact with Laird Bonnegran.
Evil? If the Laird heard of your term for his decision, you might find yourself at the wrong end of a swinging axe.
Enough, Branson! I said evil because that is the word I meant to say. You fancy yourself an assassin now? The man I knew in Pridetown was no assassin.
And yet I killed men in Pridetown.
You defended Caedale. That is not the same thing.
And now I will kill enemy soldiers. Is that not the point of war?
That is not the point!
Then it is the means to the point, yes?
It is one thing to do battle on the field of honor.
A most stupid description.
And something completely different to go hunting for victims.
As Ethelbert sent his assassins to kill Laird Delavore.
Yes. I knew then, immediately so, that the assassin could not be Branson Garibond, even when convincing evidence and King Yeselnik's declaration all pointed your way. I knew immediately that Branson, the boy I knew as the Stork, the young man who grew strong and sure, could not have done such a thing.
If I had thought it would end the war, then I would kill Bonnegran or Riondu right now. If I believed it would end the war, I would kill myself.
Ah, then you do care.
Nay, brother, I care only about that over which I might have some control. I cannot end this war, and so I care nothing about it, other than to secure my own future with the gold I intend to collect.
It is only about Branson, then?
Yes. Only about Branson and Branson's family. I cannot stop this madness and cannot save the villagers from the stomp of armies. I cannot return civilization to the now wild Southland and cannot breathe life into Jameson Sea...
Is it guilt that drives you in this evil pact with Laird Bonnegran?
The world is at war. Men die in war. I cannot stop that. And so I shall not try to. But if they are to die anyway, then better by my hand, that I might collect some gold for the sake of my family. You are wrong, then. For something good will come of it. I will fill my coffers with gold and will care for my wife and her mother and my unborn child. I'll not live the life of a peasant. Nay, and my family will not be crushed by the march of armies, for those with wealth rarely are.
Riandu tried to slap him across the face, but Branson caught the monk's hand and easily held it back.
Are you any better? Will your brothers not heal Bonnegran's warriors so that they can return to the field to die or to kill? Will you not throw bolts of killing lightning at the enemy on behalf of Laird Bonnegran?
We will heal the wounded. of both armies.
You will heal those Bonnegren brings you to heal, and they will not be men of Laird Ethelbert unless he wants to torture them when they are whole once more. Your actions support Laird Bonnegren, and so they support King Yezelnik, who has declared the leaders of your order to be heretics. So in truth, Riandu the coward, you will use the gemstones of Abel to support the cause of Father de Gilb. And even by your orders, guttural standards, he is not a man of character, wisdom, or mercy. That is the truth of it, and you cannot deny. Out of cowardice or moral indifference, you have chosen the side that opposes Father Artelevan. And while you convince yourself that you will only be acting as Father Artelevan long ago decreed, you know the truth of it. Your march beside Bonnegren aids his cause, aids Yezelnik's cause, and aids Father de Gilb's cause.
This discussion is not about me, it is about you and your choice.
Only because Riandu hasn't the courage of his espoused convictions.
You are no assassin.
Count the ears in the sack before you make such a claim.
He moved through the branches like a whisper of wind, running along limbs and lifting himself into great, near weightless leaps to land lightly on the branch of the next tree in line. The night was dark about him, but he could see well enough with his intimate knowledge of the cat's eye agate. The gemstone's magic magnified the starlight many times, and Branson quite comfortably ran along the tree branches. Near the top of a tall pine, he came to a high ridgeline, a wide valley opening before him to the south. He spotted the light of a campfire, then another.
Refugee peasants or Ethelbert scouts?
A twinkle came to Branson's eye. He looked back to the northwest, marking his position. It wouldn't be wise to be caught out here alone and lost. Branson turned back to the south and the valley far and wide below him. He reached into the malachite, seeking its levitation powers. He leaped out from the tree and drifted on the night breeze far, far into the distance. Sometime later, the highwayman caught hold of the high branches of a tall oak. He stayed in the trees for some time, again running from branch to branch. Soon after, he spotted the soft orange glow of a dying campfire. He noted a sentry, a woman clad in leather and holding a long-handled, small-bladed axe. She leaned against a tree not far from the one he stood upon. Branson smiled wickedly. Soldiers, not peasants. He moved past the woman, giving a little shake to the high branches as he did, just enough of a commotion to get her attention, but not enough to alert her to any danger, but just so that she would think it a gust of wind or a squirrel, perhaps. The sentry's interest passed quickly, as Branson knew it would, and the highwayman glided past, coming to a perch overlooking the small camp. He noted four soldiers, two men and two women, some clad in pieces of leather armor, one man stripped to the waist milling about the small fire. The highwayman moved along, walking a high perimeter of the encampment, seeking more sentries. He came back to his original perch, confident that there were only five enemies total. Five gold pieces. He moved back into the forest, coming to a branch, silently this time, above the woman sentry. She was still leaning against the tree, half asleep. Branson thought back to the Book of Jest, to the lessons of the assassin, the quick and silencing blow. He dismissed the malachite fully before he dropped from the branch. He landed behind her and drove his middle knuckle hard into the base of her skull. He made his way to the perimeter. One of the women had crawled into her bedroll. He scanned quickly, trying to discern the most dangerous of his opponents and to plan an attack route. He stepped back into the woods, closed his eyes to picture the appropriate attack routines, given the position and number of his enemies as described by the Book of Jest. Three running strides later, the highwayman leaped up high and grabbed at the power of the malachite to lift him higher and longer. The woman, sipping gruel, dropped her bowl. The other man looked up from his sharpened old sword just in time to see the highwayman land before him. The highwayman was already gone, sprinting toward the seated woman. She leaped up, her dagger out in a flash, and she stabbed ahead. Branson caught her extended arm, squirmed about to plant his leg behind her upraised arm, then drove hard against her wrist, cracking her elbow. Up he went to his feet, spinning to meet the other woman's charge. The thrusting dagger nicked his forearm, drawing blood. The highwayman kicked his leg straight up, smacking her weapon hand and sending her dagger high into the leafy canopy above. Down swept the highwayman's foot right before the woman's face. Hearing movement behind him, the highwayman spun about, his hand slapping across before him just in time to knock a thrown knife aside. The man came in furiously behind the throw as if to tackle the highwayman, who bent to the side at the waist and snap-kicked out to halt that charge with a stunning blow to the ribs. The man with the sword was up across the way. His eyes went wide when Branson stared at him, and he turned and ran off. The silver flash of a reflection caught Branson's attention, and he looked to the side to see the knife he had kicked high into the trees now lying on the ground. He slipped his toe under it, flipped it into his waiting hand, retracting with a single fluid motion. He sent the knife out end over end, burying its blade into the back of the fleeing man's thigh. The woman in the bedroll had pulled herself up to one elbow and had kicked her covers mostly aside. The highwayman surprised her when he grabbed her hard by the hair and tugged her head back viciously.
Oh, my baby girl!
Her expression reflected that hopelessness, and her whole body just relaxed in the resignation of ultimate despair. Branson Womack saw it and recognized it, and it shamed him profoundly. He let go of her hair and stumbled backward.
Damn you, King Yeselnik! Damn you, Laird Ethelbert! Damn all of you!
He hated them, all of them, for what they had done to his father and his mother and to Garibald Womack. But mostly, Branson hated them for what they had done to him, here and now, for the insanity of this absurd war that had brought him out here in the unfitting guise of a murderer. They had made the highwayman an assassin, an uncaring, unfeeling tool of murder, and nothing more.
Damn you! Damn them all!
Soon after, Branson Womack stumbled through the forest feeling more like the unbalanced stork than the cocksure and powerful highwayman. In his hand, he clenched a gemstone, a soul stone that he had used to minimize the wounds of all five of his victims. He hadn't earned his five pieces of gold. He hadn't taken them prisoner. He hadn't even robbed them. But had he done any good, truly, by following his conscience? Wouldn't they just be out there when Banagran closed in on Ethelbert, ready to join in the fight and die anyway? Or to kill some men of pride? Or Delaval, perhaps? The questions were way beyond him. Sensibility was way beyond him. He was stumbling more profoundly then, walking with an awkward and clumsy gait, falling more than once. At first he thought it was just his confusion. But as he continued on, ever more slowly, it began to dawn on him that something was very wrong here. His line of Ki Chi Kree was not holding. He felt it shivering and splintering. He stood as straight as he could and tried to walk. He was the stork. The image of the woman, her head pulled back, her lament for a child she would never again see, haunted him and closed in on him. His personal journey down Jameson Sequin's first road had led Branson to the edge of a dark and deep hole, and the stork realized, to his horror, that he had fallen in.